6.
Henchik said, "Who would he send the first time the door opens?"
Roland thought about this, absently running his hand over the bookcase Calvin Tower had insisted on sending through, the case containing the book which had so upset the pair. He did not much want to send Eddie, a man who was impulsive to begin with and now all but blinded by his concern and his love, after his wife. Yet would Eddie obey him if Roland ordered him after Tower and Deepnow instead? Roland didn't think so.
Which meant, "Gunslinger?" Henchik prodded.
"The first time the door opens, Eddie and I will go through," Roland said. "The door will shut on its own."
"Indeed it will," Henchik said. "You must be as quick as the devil's bite, or you'll likely be cut in two, half of you on the floor of this cave and the rest wherever the brown-skinned woman took herself off to."
"We'll be as quick as we can, sure," Roland said.
"Aye, that's best," Henchik said, and put his teeth on display once more. This was a smile. What's he not telling? Something he knows, or only thinks he knows. Roland would have occasion to think of not long hence. "I'd leave your guns here," Henchik said. "If you try to carry them through, you may lose them."
"I'm going to try and keep mine," Jake said. "It came from the other side, so it should be all right. If it's not, I'll get another one, somehow."
"I expect mine may travel as well," Roland said. He'd thought about this carefully and had decided to try and keep the big revolvers.
Henchik shrugged as if to say, "As you will."
"What about Oi, Jake?"
Eddie asked. Jake's eyes widened, and his jaw dropped. Roland realized the boy hadn't considered his bumbler friend until this moment. The gunslinger reflected, not for the first time, how easy it was to forget the most basic truth about John Jake Chambers. He was just a kid.
"When we went toe-dash, Oi," Jake began.
"This ain't that, sugar," Eddie said.
And when he heard Susanna's endearment coming out of his mouth, his heart gave a sad cramp. For the first time, he admitted to himself that he might never see her again, any more than Jake might see Oi once they left this stinking cave.
"But,"
Jake began, and then Oi gave a reproachful little bark. Jake had been squeezing him too tightly.
"We'll keep him for you, Jake," Cantab said gently. "Keep him very well, say true. There'll be folk posted here until he comes back for thy friend and all the rest of thy goods."
"If you ever do," was the part he was too kind to state. Roland read it in his eyes, however.
"Roland, are you sure I can't, that he can't? Now, I see. Not Toadash this time. Okay. No."
Jake reached into the front pocket of the poncho, lifted Oi out, set him on the powdery floor of the cave. He bent down, hands planted just above his knees. Oi looked up, stretching his neck so that their faces almost touched. And Roland now saw something extraordinary, not the tears in Jake's eyes, but those that had begun to well up in Oi's. A Billy Bumbler crying. It was the sort of story you might hear in a saloon as the night grew late and drunk. The faithful bumbler who wept for his departing master. You didn't believe such stories, but never said so in order to save brawling, perhaps even shooting. Yet here it was. He was seeing it. And it made Roland feel a bit like crying himself. Was it just more bumbler imitation, or did Oi really understand what was happening? Roland hoped for the former, and with all his heart.
"Oi, you have to stay with Cantab for a little while. You'll be okay. He's a pal."
"Tab,"
the bumbler repeated. Tears fell from his muzzle and darkened the powdery surface where he stood in dime-sized drops. Roland found the creature's tears uniquely awful, somehow even worse than a child's might have been.
"Ache. Ache."
"No, I got a split,"
Jake said, and wiped at his cheeks with the heels of his hands. He left dirty streaks like war paint all the way up to his temples.
No, ache.
I gotta. You stay with Cantab. I'll come back for you, Oi. Unless I'm dead, I'll come back. He hugged Oi again, then stood up. Go to Cantab. That's him, Jake pointed. Go on now. You mind me?
Ache. Tab.
The misery in that voice was impossible to deny. For a moment, Oi stayed where he was, then, still weeping, or imitating Jake's tears, Roland still hoped for that, the bumbler turned, trotted to Cantab, and sat between the young man's dusty shore boots. Eddie attempted to put an arm around Jake. Jake shook it off and stepped away from him. Eddie looked baffled. Roland kept his watch-me face, but inside he was grimly delighted. Not 13 yet, no, but there was no shortage of steel there. And it was time. Henchik.
Aye. Would you speak a word of prayer first, Roland? To whatever God beholds.
I hold to no God, Roland said. I hold to the tower, and won't pray to that. Several of Henchik's Migos looked shocked at this, but the old man himself only nodded, as if he had expected no more. He looked at Callahan.
Pear.
Callahan said, God, thy hand, thy will. He sketched a cross in the air and nodded at Henchik. If we're going, let's go. Henchik stepped forward, touched the unfound door's crystal knob, then looked at Roland. His eyes were bright.
Hear me this last time, Roland of Gilead.
I hear you very well.
I am Henchik of the Mani Kra Redpath Asturgis. We are far seers and far travelers. We are sailors on Ka's wind. Would thee travel on that wind, thee and thine?
Aye, to where it blows. Henchik slipped the chain of the Brani Bob over the back of his hand, and Roland at once felt some power let loose in this chamber. It was small as yet, but it was growing, blooming, like a rose.
How many calls would you make?
Roland held up the remaining fingers of his right hand.
Two, which is to say twim in the eld.
Two or twim, both the same, Henchik said. Kamala, come too.
He raised his voice.
Come, Mani, come, Kamala, join your force to my force. Come and keep your promise. Come and pay our debt to these gunslingers. Help me send them on their way. Now!
7. Before any of them could even begin to register the fact that Ka had changed their plans, Ka had worked its will on them. But at first it seemed that nothing at all would happen. The Mani Henchik had chosen as senders, 6 elders plus Cantab, formed their semicircle behind the door and around to its sides. Eddie took Cantab's hand and laced his fingers through the Mani's. One of the shell-shaped magnets kept their palms apart. Eddie could feel it vibrating like something alive. He supposed it was. Callahan took his other hand and gripped it firmly. On the other side of the door, Roland took Henchik's hand, weaving the Brani Bob's chain between his fingers. Now the circle was complete, save for the one spot directly in front of the door. Jake took a deep breath, looked around, saw Oi sitting against the wall of the cave about 10 feet behind Cantab, and nodded.
Oi, stay. I'll be back,
Jake sent, and then he stepped into his place. He took Callahan's right hand, hesitated, and then took Roland's left. The humming returned at once. The Brani Bob began to move, not in arcs this time, but in a small, tight circle. The door brightened and became more there. Jake saw this with his own eyes. The lines and circles of the hieroglyphs spelling unfound grew clearer. The rows etched into the doorknob began to glow. The door, however, remained closed.
Concentrate, boy.
That was Henchik's voice, so strong in his head that it almost seemed to slosh Jake's brains. He lowered his head and looked at the doorknob. He saw the rose. He saw it very well. He imagined it turning as the knob upon which it had been cast turned. Once, not so long ago, he had been obsessed by doors, and the other world, Midworld, he knew, must lie behind one of them. This felt like going back to that. He imagined all the doors he'd known in his life. Bedroom doors, bathroom doors, kitchen doors, closet doors, bowling alley doors, cloakroom doors, movie theater doors, restaurant doors, doors marked keep out, doors marked employees only, refrigerator doors, yes, even those, and then saw them all opening at once.
Open, he thought at the door, feeling absurdly like an Arabian princeling in some ancient story. Open sesame! Open sesame!
From the cave's belly far below, the voices began to babble once more. There was a whooping, windy sound, the heavy crump of something falling. The cave's floor trembled beneath their feet, as if with another beamquake. Jake paid no mind. The feeling of live force in this chamber was very strong now. He could feel it plucking at his skin, vibrating in his nose and eyes, teasing the hairs out from his scalp. But the door remained shut. He bore down more strongly on Roland's hand and the pair's, concentrating on firehouse doors, police station doors, the door to the principal's office at Piper, even a science fiction book he'd once read called The Door into Summer. The smell of the cave, deep must, ancient bones, distant drafts, seemed suddenly very strong. He felt that brilliant, exuberant uprush of certainty. Now it will happen, now, I know it will, yet the door still stayed closed. And now he could smell something else, not the cave, but the slightly metallic aroma of his own sweat rolling down his face.
Henchik, it's not working. I don't think I... Nar, not yet. And never think thee needs to do it all thyself, lad. Feel for something between you and the door, something like a hook or a thorn.
As he spoke, Henchik nodded at the manny heading the line of reinforcements.
Hedren, come forward. Thani, take hold of Hedren's shoulders. Lewis, take hold of Thani's, and on back. Do it.
The line shuffled forward. Oi barked, doubtfully.
Feel, boy, feel for that hook. It's between thee and the door. Feel for it.
Jake reached out with his mind, while his imagination suddenly bloomed with a powerful and terrifying vividness that was beyond even the clearest dreams. He saw Fifth Avenue between 48th and 60th, the 12 blocks where my Christmas bonus disappears every January, his father had liked to grumble. He saw every door on both sides of the street swinging open at once. Fendi, Tiffany, Bergdorf Goodman, Cartier, Doubleday Books, the Sherry Netherland Hotel. He saw an endless hallway floored with brown linoleum and knew it was in the Pentagon. He saw doors, at least 1,000 of them, all swinging open at once and generating a hurricane draft. Yet the door in front of him, the only one that mattered, remained closed.
Yeah, but it was rattling in its frame. He could hear it. Go, kid, Eddie said. The words came from between clamped teeth. If you can't open it, knock the fucker down. Help me, Jake shouted. Help me, goddammit, all of you.
The force in the cave seemed to double. The hum seemed to be vibrating the very bones of Jake's skull. His teeth were rattling. Sweat ran into his eyes, blurring his sight. He saw two henchicks nodding to someone behind him, Hedren and behind Hedren, Thani, and behind Thani, all the rest snaking out of the cave and down 30 feet of the path.
Get ready, lad, Henchik said.
Hedren's hand slipped under Jake's shirt and gripped the waistband of his jeans. Jake felt pushed instead of pulled. Something in his head bolted forward, and for a moment he saw all the doors of 1,000,000 worlds flung wide, generating a draft so great it could almost have blown out the sun. And then his progress was stopped. There was something right in front of the door. The hook! It's the hook! He slipped himself over it as if his mind and life force were some sort of loop. At the same time, he felt Hedren and the others pulling him backward. The pain was immediate, enormous, seeming to tear him apart. Then the draining sensation began. It was hideous, like having someone pull his guts out a loop at a time, and always the manic buzzing in his ears and deep in his brain. He tried to cry out, "No, stop, let go, it's too much!" And couldn't. He tried to scream and heard it, but only inside his head. God, he was caught on the hook and being ripped in two. One creature did hear his scream. Barking furiously, Oi darted forward. And as he did, the unfound door sprang open, swinging in a hissing arc just in front of Jake's nose.
"Behold!" Hentschik cried, in a voice that was at once terrible and exalted. "Behold, the door opens! Over Sam Common! Kanta Kankevar Common! Over Kanta!"
The others responded, but by then Jake Chambers had already been torn loose from Roland's hand on his right. By then he was flying, but not alone. Per Callahan flew with him. 8. There was just time for Eddie to hear New York, smell New York, and to realize what was happening. In a way, that was what made it so awful. He was able to register everything going diabolically counter to what he had expected, but not able to do anything about it. He saw Jake yanked out of the circle and felt Callahan's hand ripped out of his own. He saw them fly through the air toward the door, actually looping the loop in tandem like a couple of fucked-up acrobats. Something furry and barking like a motherfucker shot past the side of his head. Oi, doing barrel rolls, his ears laid back and his terrified eyes seeming to start from his head. And more. Eddie was aware of dropping Cantab's hand and lunging forward toward the door, his city, and somewhere in it, his lost and pregnant wife. He was aware, exquisitely so, of the invisible hand that pushed him back, and a voice that spoke but not in words. What Eddie heard was far more terrible than any words could have been. With words you could argue. This was only an inarticulate negation, and for all he knew, it came from the Dark Tower itself. Jake and Callahan were shot like bullets from a gun, shot into a darkness filled with the exotic sounds of honking horns and rushing traffic. In the distance, but clear, like the voices you heard in dreams, Eddie heard a rapid, rapping, ecstatic voice street-bopping its message. "Say God, brother! That's right! Say God on 2nd Avenue! Say God on Avenue B! Say God in the Bronx! I say God! I say God bomb! I say God!" The voice of an authentic New York crazy, if Eddie had ever heard one, and it laid his heart open. He saw Oi zip through the door like a piece of newspaper yanked up the street in the wake of a speeding car, and then the door slammed shut, swinging so fast and hard that he had to slit his eyes against the wind it blew into his face, a wind that was gritty with the bone dust of this rotten cave. Before he could scream his fury, the door slapped open again. This time he was dazzled by hazy sunshine loaded with birdsong. He smelled pine trees and heard the distant backfiring of what sounded like a big truck. Then he was sucked into that brightness, unable to yell that this was fucked up, ass backward. Something collided with the side of Eddie's head. For one brief moment, he was brilliantly aware of his passage between the worlds. Then the gunfire. Then the killing.
Stave. Kamala, come, coo, the wind'll blow you through. You gotta go where Ka's wind blows you, 'cause there's nothing else to do. Response. Kamala, come, too, nothing else to do. Gotta go where Ka's wind blows you, 'cause there's nothing else to do.
Third stanza. Trudy and Mia. 1. Until June 1st of 1999, Trudy Damascus was the sort of hard-headed woman who'd tell you that most UFOs were weather balloons, and those that weren't were probably the fabrications of people who wanted to get on TV. The Shroud of Turin was some 14th-century con man's trick, and that ghosts, Jacob Marley's included, were either the perceptions of the mentally ill or caused by indigestion. She was hard-headed. She prided herself on being hard-headed and had nothing even slightly spiritual in her mind as she walked down 2nd Avenue toward her business, an accounting firm called Gutenberg, Firth & Patel, with her canvas carry bag and her purse slung over her shoulder. One of GF&P's clients was a chain of toy stores called Kids Play, and Kids Play owed GF&P a goodly sum of money. The fact that they were also tottering on the edge of Chapter 11 meant El Zippo to Trudy. She wanted that $69,211.19, and had spent most of her lunch hour
In a back booth of Dennis's Waffles and Pancakes, which had been Choo Choo Mama's until 1994, mulling over ways to get it. During the last 2 years, she had taken several steps toward changing Gutenberg, Firth, and Patel to Gutenberg, Firth, Patel, and Damascus. Forcing Kisplay to cough up would be yet another step, a long one, in that direction. And so, as she crossed 46th Street toward the large, dark glass skyscraper which now stood on the uptown corner of 2nd and 46th, where there had once been a certain artistic deli and then a certain vacant lot, Trudy wasn't thinking about gods or ghosts or visitations from the spirit world. She was thinking about Richard Goldman, the asshole CEO of a certain toy company, and how... But that was when Trudy's life changed. At 1:19 p.m. EDT, to be exact. She had just reached the curb on the downtown side of the street. Was, in fact, stepping up. And all at once, a woman appeared on the sidewalk in front of her. A wide-eyed African-American woman. There was no shortage of black women in New York City, and God knew there had to be a fair percentage of them with wide eyes. But Trudy had never seen one emerge directly from thin air before. Which was what this one did. And there was something else. Something even more unbelievable. 10 seconds before, Trudy Damascus would have laughed and said nothing could be more unbelievable than a woman flicking into existence in front of her on a midtown sidewalk. But there was. There definitely was. And now, she knew how all those people who reported seeing flying saucers, not to mention ghosts wrapped in clanking chains, must feel, how they must grow frustrated by the entrenched disbelief of people like, well, people like the one Trudy Damascus had been at 1:18 p.m. on that day in June. The one who said goodbye for good on the downtown side of 46th Street. You could tell people, you don't understand, this really happened. And it cut zero ice. They said stuff like, well, she probably came out from behind the bus shelter, and you just didn't notice, or she probably came out of one of the little stores, and you just didn't notice. You could tell them that there was no bus shelter on the downtown side of 2nd and 46th, or on the uptown side for that matter, and it did no good. You could tell them there were no little stores in that area, not since 2 Hammarskjöld Plaza went up, and that didn't work either. Trudy would soon find these things out for herself, and they would drive her close to insanity. She was not used to having her perceptions dismissed as no more than a blob of mustard, or a bit of underdone potato. No bus shelter. No little shops. There were the steps going up to Hammarskjöld Plaza, where a few late lunchers were still sitting with their brown bags. But the ghost woman hadn't come from there either. The fact was this. When Trudy Damascus put her sneaker-clad left foot up on the curb, the sidewalk directly ahead of her was completely empty. As she shifted her weight preparatory to lifting her right foot up from the street, a woman appeared. For just a moment, Trudy could see 2nd Avenue through her, and something else as well, something that looked like the mouth of a cave. Then that was gone, and the woman was solidifying. It probably took only a second or two. That was Trudy's estimate. She would later think of that old saying, "If you blinked, you missed it," and wish she had blinked. Because it wasn't just the materialization. The black lady grew legs right in front of Trudy Damascus's eyes. That's right. Grew legs. There was nothing wrong with Trudy's powers of observation, and she would later tell people, fewer and fewer of whom wanted to listen, that every detail of that brief encounter was imprinted on her memory like a tattoo. The apparition was a little over 4 feet tall. That was a bit on the stumpy side for an ordinary woman, Trudy supposed, but probably not for one who quit at the knees. The apparition was wearing a white shirt, splattered with either maroon paint or dried blood, and jeans. The jeans were full and round at the thighs, where there were legs inside them, but below the knees they trailed out on the sidewalk like the shed skins of weird blue snakes. Then, suddenly, they plumped up. Plumped up. The very words sounded insane, but Trudy saw it happen. At the same moment, the woman rose from her nothing below the knee, 4'4", to her all-there height of perhaps 5'6" or 7". It was like watching some extraordinary camera trick in a movie, but this was no movie. It was Trudy's life. Over her left shoulder, the apparition wore a cloth-lined pouch that looked as if it had been woven of reeds. There appeared to be plates or dishes inside it. In her right hand, she clutched a faded red bag with a drawstring top. Something with square sides at the bottom, swinging back and forth. Trudy couldn't make out everything written on the side of the bag, but she thought part of it was Midtown Lanes. Then the woman grabbed Trudy by the arm. "What you got in that bag?" she asked. "You got shoes?" This caused Trudy to look at the black woman's feet, and she saw another amazing thing when she did. The African-American woman's feet were white as her own. Trudy had heard of people being rendered speechless. Now it had happened to her. Her tongue was stuck to the roof of her mouth and wouldn't come down. Still, there was nothing wrong with her eyes. They saw everything. The white feet, more droplets on the black woman's face, almost certainly dried blood. The smell of sweat, as if materializing on Second Avenue like this, had only come as the result of tremendous exertion. "If you got shoes, lady, you best give them to me. I don't want to kill you, but I got to get to folks that'll help me with my chap, and I can't do that barefoot." No one on this little piece of Second Avenue. People, a few anyway, sitting on the steps of 2 Hammersholt Plaza, and a couple were looking right at Trudy and the black woman, the mostly black woman, but not with any alarm or even interest. What the hell was wrong with them? Were they blind? Well, it's not them she's grabbing, for one thing, and it's not them she's threatening to kill, for another. The canvas boarder's bag with her office shoes inside it, sensible, half-heels, cordovan-colored, was snatched from her shoulder. The black woman peered inside it, then looked up at Trudy again. "What size are these?" Trudy's tongue finally came unstuck from the roof of her mouth, but that was no help. It promptly fell dead at the bottom. "Never mind, Susanna says you look like about a 7. These are—" The apparition's face suddenly seemed to shimmer. She lifted one hand. It rose in a loose loop with an equally loose fist anchoring the end, as if the woman didn't have very good control of it, and thumped herself on the forehead right between the eyes. And suddenly her face was different. Trudy had Comedy Central as part of her basic cable deal, and she'd seen stand-up comics who specialized in mimicry change their faces that same way. When the black woman spoke again, her voice had changed, too. Now it was that of an educated woman. And, Trudy would have sworn it, a frightened one. "Help me," she said. "My name is Susanna Dean, and I—oh, dear. Oh, Christ." This time it was pain that twisted the woman's face, and she clutched at her belly. She looked down. When she looked back up again, the first one had reappeared, the one who had talked of killing for a pair of shoes. She took a step back on her bare feet, still holding the bag with Trudy's nice Ferragamo low heels and her New York Times inside it. "Oh, Christ," she said. "Oh, don't that hurt. Mama, you gotta make it stop. It can't come yet, not right out here on the street. You got to make it stop a while." Trudy tried to raise her voice and yell for a cop. Nothing came out but a small, whispering sigh. The apparition pointed at her. "You want to get out of here now," she said, "and if you rouse any constabulary or raise any posse, I'll find you and cut your breasts off." She took one of the plates from the reed pouch. Trudy observed that the plate's curved edge was metal and as keen as a butcher's knife, and suddenly found herself in a struggle to keep from wetting her pants. "Find you and cut your breasts off." And an edge like the one she was looking at would probably do the job. Zip, zoop, instant mastectomy. Oh, dear Lord. "Good day to you, madam," Trudy heard her mouth saying. She sounded like someone trying to talk to the dentist before the Novocaine has worn off.
Enjoy those shoes. Wear them in good health.
Not that the apparition looked particularly healthy, not even with her legs on and her fancy white feet. Trudy walked. She walked down Second Avenue. She tried to tell herself, with no success at all, that she had not seen a woman appear out of thin air in front of 2 Hammarskjöld, the building the folks who worked there jokingly called the Black Tower. She tried to tell herself, also with no success at all, that this was what she got for eating roast beef and fried potatoes. She should have stuck to her usual waffle and egg. You went to Dennis's for waffles, not for roast beef and potatoes. And if you didn't believe that, look what had just happened to her. Seeing African-American apparitions and her bag. Her canvas boarder's bag. She must have dropped it. Knowing better. All the time expecting the woman to come after her, shrieking like a headhunter from the deepest, darkest jungles of Papua. There was a Ningley Tum place on her back. She meant a tingly, numb place. But Ningley Tum was how it actually felt, kind of loose and cool and distant, where she knew the crazy woman's plate would bite into her, drinking her blood and then eating one of her kidneys before coming to rest, still quivering in the live chalk of her spine. She would hear it coming. Somehow she knew that. It would make a whistling sound like a child's top before it chunked into her and warm blood went splashing down over her buttocks and the backs of her legs. She couldn't help it. Her bladder let go. Her urine gushed, and the front of her slacks, part of a tray expensive Norma Kamali suit, went distressingly dark. She was almost at the corner of 2nd and 45th by then. Trudy, never again to be the hard-headed woman she'd once fancied herself, was finally able to stop and turn around. She no longer felt quite so Ningley Tum, only warm at the crotch. And the woman, the mad apparition, was gone. 2. Trudy kept some softball practice clothes, T-shirts and 2 old pairs of jeans, inside her office storage cabinet. When she got back to Gutenberg, Firth and Patel, she made changing her first priority. Her second was a call to the police. The cop who took her report turned out to be Officer Paul Antasi.
"My name is Trudy Damascus," she said, "and I was just mugged on 2nd Avenue."
Officer Antasi was extremely sympathetic on the phone, and Trudy found herself imagining an Italian George Clooney. Not a big stretch, considering Antasi's name and Clooney's dark hair and eyes. Antasi didn't look a bit like Clooney in person, but hey, who expected miracles in movie stars? It was a real world they were living in. Although, considering what had happened to her on the corner of 2nd and 46th at 1:19 p.m. EDT... Officer Antasi arrived at about 3:30, and she found herself telling him exactly what had happened to her, everything, even the part about feeling Ningley Tum instead of tingly numb, and her weird certainty that the woman was getting ready to throw that dish at her. "Dish had a sharpened edge, you say?" Antasi asked, jotting on his pad, and when she said yes, he nodded sympathetically. Something about that nod had struck her as familiar. But right then she'd been too involved in telling her tale to chase down the association. Later, though, she wondered how she could possibly have been so dumb. It was every sympathetic nod she'd ever seen in one of those lady-gone-crazy films, from Girl Interrupted with Winona Ryder all the way back to The Snake Pit with Olivia de Havilland. But right then she'd been too involved. Too busy telling the nice Officer Antasi about how the apparition's jeans had been dragging on the sidewalk from the knees down. And when she was done, she for the first time heard the one about how the black woman had probably come out from behind a bus shelter. Also the one, this'll kill you, about how the black woman had probably just stepped out of some little store. There were billions of them in that neighborhood. As for Trudy, she premiered her bit about how there were no bus shelters on that corner, not on the downtown side of 46th, not on the uptown side either. Also, the one about how all the shops were gone on the downtown side since 2 Hammarskjöld went up, that would prove to be one of her most popular routines, would probably get her on stage at Radio Goddamn City someday. She was asked for the first time what she'd had for lunch just before seeing this woman, and realized, for the first time, that she'd had a 20th-century version of what Ebenezer Scrooge had eaten shortly before seeing his old and long-dead business partner, potatoes and roast beef, not to mention several blots of mustard. She forgot all about asking Officer Antasi if he'd like to go out to dinner with her. In fact, she threw him out of her office. Mitch Gutenberg poked his head in shortly thereafter. "Do they think they'll be able to get your bag back, True?"
"Get lost," Trudy said without looking up. "Right now."
Gutenberg assessed her pallid cheeks and set jaw. Then he retired without saying another word. 3. Trudy left work at 4:45, which was early for her. She walked back to the corner of 2nd and 46th, and although that ningly-tum feeling began to work its way up her legs and into the pit of her stomach again as she approached Hammarskjöld Plaza, she never hesitated. She stood on the corner, ignoring both white walk and red don't walk. She turned in a tight little circle, almost like a ballet dancer, also ignoring her fellow 2nd Avenueites and being ignored in turn. "Right here," she said. "It happened right here. I know it did. She asked me what size I was, and before I could answer, I would have answered, I would have told her what color my underwear was if she asked. I was in shock. Before I could answer, she said, 'Never mind. Susanna says you look like about a 7. These'll do.' Well, no, she hadn't quite finished that last part, but Trudy was sure that was what the woman had meant to say. Only then her face had changed. Like a comic getting ready to imitate Bill Clinton or Michael Jackson or maybe even George Clooney. And she'd asked for help. Asked for help and said her name was... what? Susanna Dean, Trudy said. That was the name. I never told Officer Antasi. Well, yeah, but fuck Officer Antasi. Officer Antasi with his bus shelters and little stores, just fuck him. That woman, Susanna Dean... Whoopi Goldberg, Coretta Scott King, whoever she was, thought she was pregnant. Thought she was in labor. I'm almost sure of it. Did she look pregnant to you, Trudes? No, she said. On the uptown side of 46th, white walk once again became red don't walk. Trudy realized she was calming down. Something about just standing here with 2 Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza on her right was calming. Like a cool hand on a hot brow, or a soothing word that assured you that there was nothing, absolutely nothing, to feel ningly-tum about. She could hear a humming, she realized. A sweet humming sound. "That's not humming," she said, as red don't walk cycled back to white walk one more time. She remembered a date in college once telling her the worst karmic disaster he could imagine would be coming back as a traffic light. "That's not humming. That's singing." And then, right beside her, startling her but not frightening her, a man's voice spoke.
"That's right," he said.
Trudy turned and saw a gentleman who looked to be in his early 40s.
"I come by here all the time just to hear it. And I'll tell you something, since we're just ships passing in the night, so to speak, when I was a young man, I had the world's most terrible case of acne. I think coming here cleared it up somehow."
"You think standing on the corner of 2nd and 46th cleared up your acne?" she said. His smile, only a small one but very sweet, faltered a tiny bit.
"I know it sounds crazy.
I saw a woman appear out of nowhere, right here," Trudy said. 3.5 hours ago, I saw this. When she showed up, she had no legs from the knees down. Then she grew the rest of them. So who's crazy, my friend?" He was looking at her, wide-eyed, just some anonymous time server in a suit with his tie pulled down at the end of the workday. And yes, she could see the pits and shadows of old acne on his cheeks and forehead.
"This is true?"
She held up her right hand. "If I'm lying, I'm dying. Bitch stole my shoes." She hesitated. "No, she wasn't a bitch. I don't believe she was a bitch. She was scared, and she was barefooted, and she thought she was in labor. I just wish I'd had time to give her my sneakers instead of my good goddamn shoes."
The man was giving her a cautious look, and Trudy Damascus suddenly felt tired. She had an idea this was a look she was going to get used to. The sign said, "Walk again," and the man who'd spoken to her started across, swinging his briefcase.
"Mister?"
He didn't stop walking, but did look back over his shoulder.
"What used to be here, back when you used to stop by for acne treatments?"
"Nothing," he said. "It was just a vacant lot behind a fence. I thought it would stop that nice sound when they built on the site, but it never did."
He gained the far curb, walked off up Second Avenue. Trudy stood where she was, lost in thought.
"I thought it would stop, but it never did." "Now why would that be?"
she asked, and turned to look more directly at 2 Hammershot Plaza. The Black Tower. The humming was stronger now that she was concentrating on it, and sweeter, not just one voice, but many of them, like a choir. Then it was gone. Disappeared as suddenly as the black woman had done the opposite.
"No, it didn't," Trudy thought. "I just lost the knack of hearing it, that's all. If I stood here long enough, I bet it would come back. Boy, this is nuts. I'm nuts."
Did she believe that? The truth was that she did not. All at once, the world seemed very thin to her, more an idea than an actual thing. And barely there at all. She had never felt less hard-headed in her life. What she felt was weak in her knees, and sick to her stomach, and on the verge of passing out. 4. There was a little park on the other side of Second Avenue. In it was a fountain. Nearby was a metal sculpture of a turtle, its shell gleaming wetly in the fountain's spray. She cared nothing for fountains or sculptures, but there was also a bench. Walk had come around again. Trudy tottered across Second Avenue like a woman of 83 instead of 38 and sat down. She began to take long, slow breaths, and after 3 minutes or so felt a little better. Beside the bench was a trash receptacle with "Keep Litter in Its Place" stenciled on the side. Below this, in pink spray paint, was an odd little graffito. "See the turtle of enormous girth." Trudy saw the turtle but didn't think much of its girth. The sculpture was quite modest. She saw something else as well. A copy of the New York Times, rolled up as she always rolled hers if she wanted to keep it a little longer and happened to have a bag to stow it in. Of course, there were probably at least 1 million copies of that day's Times floating around Manhattan, but this one was hers. She knew it even before fishing it out of the litter basket and verifying what she knew by turning to the crossword, which she'd mostly completed over lunch in her distinctive lilac-colored ink. She returned it to the litter basket and looked across Second Avenue to the place where her idea of how things worked had changed. Maybe forever.
"Took my shoes, crossed the street and sat here by the turtle and put them on. Kept my bag but dumped the Times. Why'd she want my bag? She didn't have any shoes of her own to put in it."
Trudy thought she knew. The woman had put her plates in it. A cop who got a look at those sharp edges might be curious about what you served on dishes that could cut your fingers off if you grabbed them in the wrong place.
"Okay, but then where did she go?"
There was a hotel down at the corner of 1st and 46th. Once it had been the UN Plaza. Trudy didn't know what its name was now, and didn't care, nor did she want to go down there and ask if a black woman in jeans and a stained white shirt might have come in a few hours ago. She had a strong intuition that her version of Jacob Marley's ghost had done just that, but here was an intuition she didn't want to follow up on. Better to let it go. The city was full of shoes, but sanity. One's sanity. Better to head home, take a shower, and just let it go.
"Except something is wrong," she said, and a man walking past on the sidewalk looked at her. She looked back defiantly. "Somewhere, something is very wrong. It's—"
Tipping was the word that came to mind.
but she would not say it. As if to say it would cause the tip to become a topple. It was a summer of bad dreams for Trudy Damascus. Some were about the woman who first appeared and then grew. These were bad, but not the worst. In the worst ones, she was in the dark, and terrible chimes were ringing, and she sensed something tipping further and further toward the point of no return.
Stave. Kamala, come, Key, can you tell me what you see? Is it ghosts or just the mirror that makes you want to flee? Response. Kamala, come, three, I beg you, tell me. Is it ghosts or just your darker self that makes you want to flee?
Fourth stanza. Susanna's Dogen. 1. Susanna's memory had become distressingly spotty, unreliable, like the half-stripped transmission of an old car. She remembered the battle with the wolves, and Mia waiting patiently while it went on. No, that wasn't right. Wasn't fair. Mia had been doing a lot more than waiting patiently. She'd been cheering Susanna and the others on with her own warrior's heart, holding the labor in abeyance while her chap surrogate mother dealt death with her plates. Only the wolves had turned out to be robots, so could you really say, yes, yes, you can, because they were more than robots, much more, and we killed them. Rose up righteous and killed their asses. But that was neither here nor there, because it was over. And once it was, she had felt the labor coming back, and strong. She was going to have the kid at the side of the damn road if she didn't look out, and there it would die, because it was hungry. Mia's chap was hungry, and you got to help me. Mia. And impossible not to respond to that cry. Even while she felt Mia pushing her aside, as Roland had once pushed Detta Walker aside, it was impossible not to respond to that wild mother's cry. Partly, Susanna supposed, because it was her body they shared, and the body had declared itself on behalf of the baby. Probably could not do otherwise. And so she had helped. She had done what Mia herself no longer could do, had stopped the labor a bit longer. Although that in itself would become dangerous to the chap. Funny how that word insinuated itself into her thoughts, became her word as well as Mia's word, if it was allowed to go on too long. She remembered a story some girl had told during a late-night hen party in the dorm at Columbia, half a dozen of them sitting around in their PJs, smoking cigarettes and passing a bottle of Wild Irish Rose, absolutely verboten and therefore twice as sweet. The story had been about a girl their age, on a long car trip, a girl who'd been too embarrassed to tell her friends she needed a pee stop. According to the story, the girl had suffered a ruptured bladder and died. It was the kind of tale you simultaneously thought was bullshit and believed absolutely. And this thing with the chap, the baby. But whatever the danger, she'd been able to stop the labor. Because there were switches that could do that somewhere in the Dogen. Only the machinery in the Dogen had never been meant to do what she, they, us, we were making it do. Eventually, it would overload and rupture. All the machines would catch fire, burn out. Alarms going off, control panels and TV screens going dark. How long before that happened? Susanna didn't know. She had a vague memory of taking her wheelchair out of a bucka wagon while the rest of them were distracted, celebrating their victory and mourning their dead. Climbing and lifting weren't easy when you were legless from the knees down, but they weren't as hard as some folks might believe either. Certainly she was used to mundane obstacles, everything from getting on and off the toilet to getting books off a shelf that had once been easily accessible to her. There had been a step stool for such chores in every room of her New York apartment. In any case, Mia had been insisting, had actually been driving her as a cowboy might drive a stray doggy. And so Susanna had hoisted herself into the bucca, had lowered the wheelchair down, and then had lowered herself neatly into it. Not quite as easy as rolling off a log, but far from the hardest chore she'd ever done since losing her last 16 inches or so. The chair had taken her one last mile,
maybe a little more. No legs for Mia, daughter of none, not in the Kala. Then it smashed into a spur of granite, spilling her out. Luckily, she'd been able to break her fall with her arms, sparing her turbulent and unhappy belly. She remembered picking herself up. Correction, she remembered Mia picking up Susanna Dean's hijacked body and working her way on up the path. She had only one other clear memory from the Kala side, and that was of trying to stop Mia from taking off the rawhide loop Susanna wore around her neck. A ring hung from it, a beautiful light ring that Eddie had made for her. When he'd seen it was too big, meaning it as a surprise, he hadn't measured her finger, he had been disappointed and told her he'd make her another. "You go on and do just that if you like," she'd said, "but I'll always wear this one." She had hung it around her neck, liking the way it felt between her breasts, and now here was this unknown woman, this bitch, trying to take it off. Detta had come forward, struggling with Mia. Detta had had absolutely no success in trying to reassert control over Roland, but Mia was no Roland of Gilead. Mia's hands dropped away from the rawhide. Her control wavered. When it did, Susanna felt another of those labor pains sweep through her, making her double over and groan. "It has to come off," Mia shouted. "Otherwise they'll have his scent as well as yours. Your husband's. You don't want that, believe me." "Who?" Susanna had asked. "Who are you talking about?" "Never mind, there's no time, but if he comes after you, and I know you think he'll try, they mustn't have his scent. I'll leave it here, where he'll find it. Later, if Ka wills, you may wear it again." Susanna had thought of telling her they could wash the ring off, wash Eddie's smell off it. But she knew it wasn't just a smell Mia was speaking of. It was a love ring, and that scent would always remain. But for whom? The wolves, she supposed, the real wolves, the ones in New York, the vampires of whom Callahan had spoken, and the low men. Or was there something else? Something even worse?
"Help me!"
Mia cried, and again Susanna found that cry impossible to resist. The baby might or might not be Mia's, and it might or might not be a monster, but her body wanted to have it. Her eyes wanted to see it, whatever it was, and her ears wanted to hear it cry, even if the cries were really snarls. She had taken the ring off, kissed it, and then dropped it at the foot of the path where Eddie would surely see it. Because he would follow her at least this far, she knew it. Then what? She didn't know. She thought she remembered riding on something most of the way up a steep path, surely the path which led to the doorway cave, then blackness. Not blackness. No, not complete blackness. There were blinking lights. The low glow of television screens that were, for the time being, projecting no pictures but only soft gray light. The faint hum of motors. The click of relays. This was the Dogon, Jake's Dogon, some sort of control room. Maybe a place she had constructed herself, maybe her imagination's version of a Quonset hut Jake had found on the west side of the River Wye. The next thing she remembered clearly was being back in New York. Her eyes were windows she looked through as Mia stole some poor terrified woman's shoes. Susanna came forward again, asking for help. She meant to go on, to tell the woman she needed to go to the hospital, needed a doctor, she was going to have a baby and something was wrong with it. Before she could get any of that out, another labor pain washed over her, this one monstrous, deeper than any pain she had ever felt in her life, worse even than the pain she'd felt after the loss of her lower legs. This, "Oh, Christ," she said. But Mia took over again before she could say anything else, telling Susanna that she had to make it stop, and telling the woman that if she whistled for any John Laws, she'd lose a pair of something a lot more valuable to her than shoes. "Mia, listen to me," Susanna told her. "I can stop it again. I think I can, but you have to help. You have to sit down. If you don't settle for a while, God himself won't be able to stop your labor from running its course. Do you understand? Do you hear me?" Mia did. She stayed where she was for a moment, watching the woman from whom she'd stolen the shoes. Then, almost timidly, she asked a question. "Where should I go?" Susanna sensed that her kidnapper was for the first time becoming aware of the enormous city in which she now found herself. was finally seeing the surging schools of pedestrians, the floods of metal carriages, every third one, it seemed, painted a yellow so bright it almost screamed, and towers so high that on a cloudy day their tops would have been lost to view. Two women looked at an alien city through one set of eyes. Susanna knew it was her city, but in many ways it no longer was. She'd left New York in 1964. How many years further along was this? 20? 30? Never mind. Let it go. Now was not the time to worry about it. Their combined gaze settled on the little pocket park across the street. The labor pains had ceased for the time being, and when the sign over there said walk, Trudy Damascus's black woman, who didn't look particularly pregnant, crossed, walking slowly but steadily. On the far side was a bench beside a fountain and a metal sculpture. Seeing the turtle comforted Susanna a little. It was as if Roland had left her this sign, what the gunslinger himself would have called a sigil. "He'll come after me, too," she told Mia. "And you should wear him, woman. You should wear him very well."
"I'll do what I need to do," Mia replied. "You want to see the woman's papers? Why?"
"I want to see when this is. The newspaper will say." Brown hands pulled the rolled-up newspaper from the canvas boarder's bag, unrolled it, and held it up to blue eyes that had started that day as brown as the hands. Susanna saw the date, June 1st, 1999, and marveled over it. Not 20 years or even 30, but 35. Until this moment, she hadn't realized how little she'd thought of the world's chances to survive so long. The contemporaries she'd known in her old life, fellow students, civil rights advocates, drinking buddies, and folk music aficionados, would now be edging into late middle age. Some were undoubtedly dead.
"Enough," Mia said, and tossed the newspaper back into the trash barrel, where it curled into its former rolled shape.
She brushed as much dirt as she could from the soles of her bare feet. Because of the dirt, Susanna did not notice they had changed color, and then put on the stolen shoes. They were a little tight, and with no socks, she supposed they'd give her blisters if she had to walk very far, but...
"What do you care, right?" Susanna asked her. "Ain't your feet?"
And knew as soon as she'd said it, for this was a form of talking, what Roland called palaver, that she might be wrong about that. Certainly her own feet, those which had marched obediently through life below the body of Odetta Holmes and sometimes Detta Walker, were long gone, rotting or, more likely, burned in some municipal incinerator. But she did not notice the change in color. Except later she'd think, "You noticed all right. Noticed it and blocked it right out. Because too much is too much." Before she could pursue the question, as much philosophical as it was physical, of whose feet she now wore, another labor pain struck her. It cramped her stomach and turned it to stone even as it loosened her thighs. For the first time, she felt the dismaying and terrifying need to push.
"You have to stop it," Mia cried. "Woman, you have to, for the chap's sake and for ours, too."
"Yes, all right, but how?" "Close your eyes," Susanna told her.
"What? Didn't you hear me? You've got to—"
"I heard you," Susanna said. "Close your eyes." The park disappeared. The world went dark. She was a black woman, still young and undoubtedly beautiful, sitting on a park bench beside a fountain and a metal turtle with a wet and gleaming metal shell. She might have been meditating on this warm late spring afternoon in the year of 1999.
"I'm going away for a little while now," Susanna said. "I'll be back. In the meantime, sit where you are. Sit quiet. Don't move. The pain should draw back again, but even if it doesn't at first, sit still. Moving around will only make it worse. Do you understand me?"
Mia might be frightened, and she was certainly determined to have her way, but she wasn't dumb. She asked only a single question.
"Where are you going?"
"Back to the Dogen," Susanna said. "My Dogen. The one inside." 2.
The building Jake had found on the far side of the River Wye was some sort of ancient communications and surveillance post. The boy had described it to them in some detail, but he still might not have recognized Susanna's imagined version of it, which was based on a technology which had been far out of date only 13 years later, when Jake had left New York for Midworld. In Susanna's win, Lyndon Johnson had been president and color TV was still a curiosity. Computers were huge things that filled whole buildings. Yet Susanna had visited the city of Ludd and seen some of the wonders there, and so Jake might have recognized the place where he had hidden from Ben Sleightman and Andy the Messenger Robot after all. Certainly he would have recognized the dusty linoleum floor with its checkerboard pattern of black and red squares and the rolling chairs along consoles filled with blinking lights and glowing dials. And he would have recognized the skeleton in the corner, grinning above the frayed collar of its ancient uniform shirt. She crossed the room and sat in one of the chairs. Above her, black and white TV screens showed dozens of pictures. Some were of Colibrin Sturgis, the town common, Callahan's church, the general store, the road leading east out of town. Some were still pictures like studio photographs. One of Roland, one of a smiling Jake holding Oi in his arms, and one, she could hardly bear to look at it, of Eddie, with his hat tipped back cowpoke style and his whittling knife in one hand. Another monitor showed the slim black woman sitting on the bench beside the turtle, knees together, hands folded in her lap, eyes closed, a pair of stolen shoes on her feet. She now had 3 bags, the one she'd stolen from the woman on Second Avenue, the rush sack with the sharpened orizas in it, and a bowling bag. This one was a faded red, and there was something with square corners inside it, a box. Looking at it in the TV screen made Susanna feel angry, betrayed. But she didn't know why. The bag was pink on the other side, she thought. It changed color when we crossed, but only a little. The woman's face on the black and white screen above the control board grimaced. Susanna felt an echo of the pain Mia was experiencing, only faint and distant. Got to stop that, and quick. The question still remained. How? The way you did on the other side. While she was horsing her freight up to that cave just as fast as she damn could. But that seemed a long time ago now, in another life. And why not? It had been another life, another world. And if she ever hoped to get back there, she had to help right now. So what had she done? You used this stuff, that's what you did. It's only in your head, anyway. What Professor Overmeyer called a visualization technique back in Psych 1. Close your eyes. Susanna did so. Now both sets of eyes were closed, the physical ones that Mia controlled in New York and the ones in her mind. Visualize. She did. Or tried. Open. She opened her eyes. Now, on the panel in front of her, there were 2 large dials and a single toggle switch where before there had been rheostats and flashing lights. The dials looked to be made of Bakelite, like the oven dials on her mother's stove back in the house where Susanna had grown up. She supposed there was no surprise there. All you imagined, no matter how wild it might seem, was no more than a disguised version of what you already knew. The dial on her left was labeled Emotional Temp. The markings on it ran from 32 to 212. 32 in blue, 212 in bright red. It was currently set at 160. The dial in the middle was marked Labor Force. The numbers around its face went from 0 to 10, and it was currently turned to 9. The label under the toggle switch simply read CHAP, and there were only 2 settings, Awake and Asleep. It was currently set to Awake. Susanna looked up and saw one of the screens was now showing a baby in utero. It was a boy. A beautiful boy. His tiny penis floated like a strand of kelp below the lazy curl of his umbilical cord. His eyes were open, and although the rest of the image was black and white, those eyes were a piercing blue. The chap's gaze seemed to go right through her. They're Roland's eyes, she thought, feeling stupid with wonder. How can that be? It couldn't, of course. All this was nothing but the work of her own imagination, a visualization technique. But if so, why would she imagine Roland's blue eyes? Why not Eddie's hazel ones? Why not her husband's hazel eyes? No time for that now. Do what you have to do. She reached out to emotional temp with her lower lip caught between her teeth. On the monitor, showing the park bench, Mia also began biting her lower lip. She hesitated, then dialed it back to 72, exactly as if it was a thermostat. And wasn't it? Calm immediately filled her. She relaxed in her chair and let her lip escape the grip of her teeth. On the park monitor, the black woman did the same. All right. So far, so good. She hesitated for a moment with her hand not quite touching the labor force dial, then moved on to chap instead. She flipped the toggle from awake to asleep. The baby's eyes closed immediately. Susanna found this something of a relief. Those blue eyes were disconcerting. All right, back to labor force. Susanna thought this was the important one, what Eddie would call the big casino. She took hold of the old-fashioned dial, applied a little experimental force, and was not exactly surprised to find the clunky thing dully resistant in its socket. It didn't want to turn. But you will, Susanna thought, because we need you to. We need you to. She grasped it tightly and began turning it slowly counterclockwise. A pain went through her head and she grimaced. Another momentarily constricted her throat, as if she'd gotten a fishbone stuck in there, but then both pains cleared. To her right, an entire bank of lights flashed on, most of them amber, a few bright red.
"Warning,"
said a voice that sounded eerily like that of Blaine the Mono. "This operation may exceed safety parameters." No shit, Sherlock, Susanna thought. The labor force dial was now down to 6. When she turned it past 5, another bank of amber and red lights flashed on, and 3 of the monitors showing Kala scenes shorted out with sizzling pops. Another pain gripped her head like invisible pressing fingers. From somewhere beneath her came the start-up whine of motors or turbines. Big ones from the sound. She could feel them thrumming against her feet, which were bare, of course. Mia had gotten the shoes. Oh, well, she thought, I didn't have any feet at all before this, so maybe I'm ahead of the game.
Warning, said the mechanical voice. What you're doing is dangerous, Susanna of New York. Hear me, I beg. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
One of Roland's proverbs occurred to her. You do what you need to, and I'll do what I need to, and we'll see who gets the goose. She wasn't sure what it meant, but it seemed to fit this situation, so she repeated it aloud as she slowly but steadily turned the labor force dial past 4 to 3. She meant to turn the dial all the way back to 1, but the pain which ripped through her head when the absurd thing passed 2 was so huge, so sickening, that she dropped her hand. For a moment the pain continued, intensified even, and she thought it would kill her. Mia would topple off the bench where she was sitting, and both of them would be dead before their shared body hit the concrete in front of the turtle sculpture. Tomorrow or the next day, her remains would take a quick trip to Potter's Field. And what would go on the death certificate? Stroke? Heart attack? Or maybe that old standby of the medical man in a hurry, natural causes? But the pain subsided, and she was still alive when it did. She sat in front of the console with the 2 ridiculous dials and the toggle switch, taking deep breaths and wiping the sweat from her cheeks with both hands. Boy howdy, when it came to visualization technique, she had to be the champ of the world. This is more than visualization. You know that, right? She supposed she did. Something had changed her, had changed all of them. Jake had gotten the touch, which was a kind of telepathy. Eddie had grown, was still growing, into some sort of ability to create powerful, talismanic objects. One of them had already served to open a door between 2 worlds. And she?
I see. That's all, except if I see it hard enough, it starts to be real. The way Detta Walker got to be real.
All over this version of the Dogon, amber lights were glowing. Even as she looked, some turned red. Beneath her feet, special guest feet, she thought them, the floor trembled and thrummed. Enough of this, and cracks would start to appear in its elderly surface. Cracks that would widen and deepen. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the House of Usher.
Susanna got up from the chair and looked around. She should go back. Was there anything else that needed doing before she did?
One thing occurred to her.